conscious leadership is like being the captain of a ship. Just as a captain is responsible for navigating the vessel towards its destination, a mindful leader is responsible for steering the organization towards its goals while considering the greater good. To be a conscious leader means to be aware of the impact of one's actions, decisions, and behaviors on the people and the planet. It means leading with empathy, compassion, and a sense of purpose. It means embracing diversity and inclusion and creating a culture of transparency and accountability. But why do we need to have conscious conversations? Just as a ship cannot reach the destination without the captain communicating with the crew and making informed decisions based on the conditions and circumstances, an organization cannot thrive without leaders having open and honest conversations with their employees, customers, and stakeholders. Conscious conversations are meaningful because they allow us to understand each other's perspectives, build trust, and collaborate towards a common goal. They enable us to identify the issues that matter most and find ways to address them constructively and meaningfully. In today's world, where social, environmental, and economic challenges are becoming increasingly complex and interconnected, we need conscious leadership and conscious conversations more than ever. We need leaders who are willing to take a stand for what is right, committed to creating positive change, and can inspire and empower others to do the same. So delve into the world of conscious leadership and explore the power of conscious conversations. We'll hear from experts, thought leaders, and change makers making a difference in their organization and communities. We'll learn about the challenges, the strategies, and lessons they have learned along the way. Together, we can create a world where conscious leadership and conversations are the norms, where businesses and organizations are driven by a sense of purpose and a commitment to making a positive impact. So let's sail on this journey of discovery and let's navigate towards a better future for all. Welcome back, Conscious Leaders. I am your host, Carmen Murray, and today's episode is an important one. We are often told that politics is something to avoid, especially as women, that it's messy, confrontational, and it's not our place. Yet whether we like it or not, politics is everywhere, and you need to earn political literacy to shape policy, whatever it is you want to change. Today, we are sitting down with someone who has been at the very center of power, policy, and pressure, particularly during one of the most defining moments in modern history, the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm joined by Dr. Lwazi Manzi, health diplomat to the presidency and medical doctor and strategic leader who has served South Africa at the highest levels of global and regional health governance. Dr. Manzi currently also serves as the head of the secretariat of the Global Leaders Network for Women and Children and Adolescent Health, as well as head of secretariat of the African Union Champion on Pandemic Prevention. Oh, it's quite a mouthful, hey?
Yes, it is.
You are doing so much.
PPR.
Prevention, preparedness, and response, supporting President Cyril Ramaphosa in his global and continental leadership roles. Mm-hmm. Now, you are doing so many things. So first of all, a warm welcome, Lwazi. I'm so excited
Thank
to
you.
Have you here.
Thank
we are
you.
Going to unpack things like never before today, and I think that our community is going to learn so much from you today.
Thanks for having me.
So, now that I'm getting older, I have to wear glasses.
Go
I'm going to put them on. You know how it goes from a health perspective.
My eyes are watering as well. So.
You want to borrow
the
them?
The age is truly catching up to us.
I'm telling you. Lwazi, before we even get started, what is your message that you want to share with us today, that you want us to take away?
Show up. I know a lot of people say it, but just show up. Mm. The first rule of life is to show up. We were working on the G20 last year, and I was very, very fortunate to work together with former President Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka. And, you know, a lot of people may not understand how things work with things like the G20 and all of that. Now, the G20 is actually an informal, as powerful as it is, but it's actually an informal coalition of heads of state and government and their countries. And we know that there was one that didn't show up.
Oh, yes, we know that one.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we went ahead and we actually went ahead and adopted a declaration without them. Now, I'm just saying this because one of the first, when we had our first meeting to deal with the G20 social summit with former deputy president. Those of us who were in that meeting, we all volunteered. Nobody appointed us. Nobody said, you know, nobody said, oh, you must do this job. We all volunteered and we said that we're going to be helping out with the G20 social summit. And so she said to us, thank you, because the first rule of life is to show up. And so that really is it. And you don't have to necessarily be prepared. You don't necessarily have to be the smartest or the most qualified or the most beautiful or the most anything. You just have to know that you want to be there and that you want to do something. You don't even need to even know what you need to do. Just if you know that you want to be there and you want to be part of a particular cause or a particular objective or a particular action, first things first, show up. Then we take it
I
from
I love
there.
That call to action, because so many times we wait for everything to be perfect. Yes, yes. And that is what holds us back.
Yeah, and men don't do that.
Yeah.
They just pitch.
Sure.
And they pitch and they dive in. And you know, I did a leadership course with Vital. It wasn't a course, it was more kind of just a few weeks of intervention with Vital Voices in the US. And one of the first things they taught us is that they were looking at studies which showed when men and women prepare for an interview or prepare for a particular application, and they look at the criteria, women tend to want to tick at least 90% of the criteria before they will actually even apply for a job. Whereas men, if they tick maybe 2 or 3 out of 10 things, they're like, ah, yeah, no, I'm good.
Yeah.
And they go for the job.
You know what's very interesting? I saw a Harvard research study that also spoke to the fact that women come more prepared into boards and they have more questions to ask. And those questions are actually the questions that shape strategy.
Yeah,
and if you just come prepared with the questions that you want to ask, not needing to know everything, be curious.
Absolutely. Look, preparation is extremely important for showing up, and that's fine. But what I would like this community and other people to understand is that if you feel unprepared, don't be deterred to not show up. You know, you can show up and you can be present, you know. And that's why the issue of mindfulness becomes very, very important, in that, yes, if you're prepared and you're strategic and all of those things, that's all very advantageous. But it's only advantageous if you're there.
Yeah.
So really it's about, because showing up is actually the hardest part, and yet it's actually the easiest thing to do. And then after that, everything else follows.
Beautiful. I love that. Okay. So before we enter this conversation, which is going to go deep, what makes you proud to be South African?
I love this country. If you ask any of my friends, my family, I am a patriot through and through. I love this country. I've traveled everywhere. I can tell you right now, there's no place like South Africa. What makes me proud to be South African is that South Africa is a country where basically there's no excuse. You've got everything. There's no other country where you have everything like South Africa. You have every type of landscape that you can possibly imagine. You have a constitution that allows you to pretty much do whatever you want. And people do whatever they want in this country, right?
I mean, we see it on the stage all the time,
right? So people do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And then there are some people who complain about people doing whatever they want. It's like, no, you can also do whatever you want, actually, right? You really can. Of course.
Well, I don't know if that's a good message. Well, it all depends.
No, it's a good starting point.
Yeah.
Yes, there is the rule of law. Right, there are rights and responsibilities. There's the Bill of Rights and Responsibilities.
Yes.
You know, there's the law and all of that. But the starting point is that you can do whatever. There are countries, particularly especially in Africa, where you cannot do whatever you want. You know, in law, and some of those laws are very much unjustified.
Mm.
You know, and some of them are, of course, human rights atrocities. But in this country, you don't have that. You have freedom of speech. People do say whatever they want in this country, and you can too. You have the greatest schools in the world. You really do. They are the greatest schools in the world in this country.
Sure.
Right? We have some of the greatest scientists, the greatest innovators in the world. they may not be in South Africa, but they come from South Africa. And the richest man in the world, as much as he would like to deny it, was born and bred and educated in this country and took all of those resources to America and built his prosperity. But he built his prosperity off of the investment that this country made into him and his family. Sure. And his community around him.
Sure.
Right? You have the most incredible people in this country. We take it for granted that, yes, fine, we have our problems, but you take it for granted that you walk the street and people greet you. Mm. You take it for granted that you might have a whole conversation with somebody that you don't know.
Yeah.
In a taxi, on the road, in the theater, anywhere. And it'll be a whole conversation, deep conversation. It doesn't happen everywhere in the world. I had a friend of mine who visited from the Netherlands, and he said to me that we have been friends since he started visiting, since he was 18. And he said to me that he was so fascinated by this whole community thing that we have in South Africa that he did some research around it. And he said that mental health is not actually, or at least what he read, is that mental health is not dependent on, you know, how well you're able to manage your emotions or the socioeconomic situation that you find yourself. It is actually dependent on your everyday contact with ordinary people on a daily basis, and especially those people that you don't know. And I have, in fact, read quite a number of study outcomes that have consistently shown this. The everyday contact that you actually have with people that you love and people that you are in your neighborhood or in your community and people that you don't know is what actually determines the quality of your mental health.
Sure.
So I can go on about the things that make this country great and the reason why I'm proud to be South African. Maybe the bottom line is that I'm proud to be South African because there's somebody like me in South Africa, somebody who grew up from the township and is now working in the highest office in the land, and against all the odds.
Yeah.
Lawful racism, which was apartheid, because I grew up in the tail end of apartheid, and there were a lot of obstructions along the way in my various careers. I'm a woman, I'm a black woman, you know. I've generally entered into careers that are male-dominated, very, very difficult careers, and certainly not careers that are conducive to raising a family. I have been a medical doctor and in the front lines of emergency medicine. I have been a DJ.
Oh, I love that. What? Yes. That's so cool.
I have been a film and television producer, and now I'm in high-level politics. The fact that all of this has been possible in this country is what makes me particularly proud.
One of the conversations amongst our community, we're always talking about, listen, we might have our disadvantages and we might have gone through a lot of trials and tribulations, but when we look at what is happening on the global stage, we have so much to offer the world. The world can learn so much from us.
We are offering a lot to the world.
Yeah.
We are already offering a lot, including human resources, comes out of this country.
Absolutely. Now let's go back. You grew up in a political family. Talk me through, what is it like to grow up in a political family? Not many have understood that, and what it requires of you as an individual and the expectations that are put on you as a young child.
Yeah, I think no two political families, as it were, are the same. Growing up in a political family, you don't know that you're growing up in a political family. But I will say that the first time I realized that there is something about growing up in a political family that makes it a bit different is when we received a report, and my parents were extremely proud. I think I was maybe standard one, standard two, but it was definitely the new school that I've gone into. And the teacher remarked in the final comments that she was highly impressed with my knowledge of current affairs and my ability to actually discuss current affairs, right? So I remember that because then I was like, obviously, you know, like, what else is there to talk about? But when I look back now, I realize that it must have been a very peculiar thing for them to witness. And I mean, this was a private white school. I had moved from class one to class two. In class one, I was in a school in the township and all that. Then my parents moved me into a private school. But it was pretty much mostly white, and it was just people who were just totally oblivious about what was going on around them. And of course, the children, they were just, you know, white rich children who were just living their white rich lives. So I only appreciated now what she was actually saying, that it was indeed something unique. So I think children who grow up in political families, I think maybe the first thing is that they're very, very much aware of what's going on around them in their countries and in the world, and what the implications are for their everyday lives, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe the important part. And I mean, I can't speak for all of us who grew up in a political family, but I certainly think that the advantage is that we do have an understanding that your individual actions are actually what determines political outcomes. It's so not true. Something that's happening somewhere out there, you know. And then we also obviously then, you know, have an understanding of the political machinery and how things work. And then, of course, all of the dirt and the complications, etc. Now, that part, the last part that I'm talking about, is something that I became more and more aware of as I was growing up. And by the time I left high school, I was like, I don't think I'm going to be a part of this, you know. But knowing very well I said it, but I knew that it was absolutely unrealistic.
Why was it unrealistic?
Well, I think the first thing is exactly what I've said, is that it's unrealistic to believe for anybody that you're not part of politics. I can tell you right now, wherever you sit, whether you are doing nothing or you're doing something, and whether that thing is directly related to politics or not, you are doing something to determine the outcomes, or political outcomes of this country.
Wow.
So that is, I think that is something that we all need to understand, not just as South Africans, as humanity.
Mm.
There are some countries where I go, and it strikes me that the general citizen is very, very much alive to that reality.
Yeah.
And they are active citizens, and they participate actively. And you can tell that, you know, this is something that is just, you know, par for the course, you know, just for a citizen of that country. And then there are some countries where the political activity entirely sits in the political arena. And the citizens, you can see, are really just passive participants. But there are participants.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference. But I'm also getting so concerned about the apathy economy. You know, South Africa has got one of the highest, consumption times in the world online.
Mm.
We consume a lot of social media. And there is so much polarization experiments that are being done by these big tech companies. They call it neo-colonialism. Mm. I know it's maybe a very controversial discussion.
No, it's. I don't think. No, it's not controversial, but I think I'm just trying to think of my answer, because I may not be answering your question, but this is what I'd like to say. I think we're going to talk about COVID, and we'll talk about social media and what it can do in terms of mob mentality. But let me say this. Social media is also like politics.
Mm.
You can make of it what you will. And let's give you an example. The Arab Spring. The Arab Spring was almost entirely born, cultivated, and sprung from social media. There was no misinformation there. There was no disinformation. There was no nefarious objective, and it was organized, very, very well organized.
Mm.
And the youth of Egypt and some of the other sort of Middle East/Mediterranean countries used social media as a tool to organize and rise up and overthrow a government that was corrupt and that was not delivering on the national plans. And the government that's in place now, is, in my opinion, wonderful, I think. I think it's a fantastic government. It's not the government that did take over, but you can see that they have the discipline of knowing that any day on social media, they can be gone. Now, to answer your question, what do I think about the effects of social media on the apathy economy? I think certainly it contributes a lot to apathy because when people sit and doom scroll, they don't process the information properly.
Yes.
Right. And so if you can't really process information properly, it does become a bit difficult to take action. But as I say, it does mean that, once again, you have to be mindful and that you have to look at it differently as a platform. And this is something that we're evolving into as a humanity, because social media is, 15 years old?
Yeah.
So it's something that really we're just grappling with. And we're grappling with it, and it's outpacing our ability to actually process its scale and its scope and its potential impact on human interactions.
Yes.
Right. So it's really, really something that does require us to be very mindful and to organize the space in the same way that we organized television when it came along.
Yeah.
Television, when it came along, was also chaotic. It also brought a lot of concerns about how it's going to influence society and children and all of that kind of stuff. And it took some time for governments to put in laws in place to make the space more organized and to protect people from harmful content. So it's the same thing that we need to do. And we did do that, actually, during COVID, and we'll talk a little bit more about that.
I can't wait for us to unpack that. The thing that I often think about is we live in an age of spectacle. So it's like literally we are watching the tech lords and leaders that are not leaders do their thing. But at the same time, it reminds me of the time of the gladiators, where the emperor used to bring into his arena the gladiators, the slaves and the prisoners, put them into the arena, fight and with violence, and then they had people that would do the speeches and provoke the audiences, and there's so much polarization and they're bloodthirsty. And then the emperor would sit and he would lift his thumb to say kill him or put his thumb down. And it reminds me of social media, kind of like the likes and the comment sections are becoming the battlefields and this polarization, and how the algorithms have started to work around rage bait. And where the more negative we are and horrible we are towards each other, the more that gets fueled to keep you in the platforms. And people are just going, I've had enough now. I'm actually leaving these platforms. We call it the analog renaissance, where we're seeing this a lot in our trend analysis. And it's so interesting to me, but it's also concerning to me, because there's always this report of social media is growing and it's expanding, but then we're seeing this big massive underground movement that's happening where people are going offline, yet the numbers stay the same, which is the bot economy and the AI personas and this mixed version of good and bad bots that are there. And these are the conversations that we need to start having, is what is real, what's not, what is a real interaction, what's not. So I think this is a great segue for us to move into the COVID, right? I remember during the pandemic, I had to predict the outcome of the elections, the 2021 elections. And I was also tasked to, work on the pandemic. And I have never seen so much polarization in my life. It was really sad to see how people were going, don't take the jab, take the jab, and these weird things that were happening. But do you know that over 12 accounts in the world constituted, I think, for about 90% of the misinformation?
Yes, we were aware of that.
And I want to hear what happened behind the scenes, like the moment, where were you the moment you found out this is happening and this is real?
Sure. So I'll start with that timeline, and then I'll talk a little bit about trying to handle the issue of social media and bots and all of that. And by the way, we started dealing with that matter already when we were dealing with NHI. So it was. So by the time COVID came, it was something that we were already tackling. But we did, of course, have to make some drastic decisions and actions with the MNOs. But I'll talk about that just now. Where was I when we found out about the COVID pandemic? I honestly do not remember.
Was that chaotic, eh?
I really don't remember. But we were told that, yes, we saw on the news that there was a bug that was doing the rounds. It hadn't been named yet at the time in China, and that it had a mortality of 20% at the time, and they didn't know what it was. So what we did then as a ministry is that when we saw that, and I mean, I think I did first hear it on the news. I think also the minister did first hear it on the news. And then we asked the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, the NICD, which I think nobody knew before COVID, and then everybody knew during COVID. We asked them to check it out for us. And this was in, I think, around November. I think, yeah, it was towards the tail end of November. And it was November, right? Yeah. And then the NICD said to us, well, it is quite a virulent bug. They're still doing some research on it. But they were very calm about it. They were like, oh, we'll just keep an eye on things. We'll let you know. We do definitely expect that there'll be some, you know, cross-border transmission and all of that. But we'll keep an eye on things. We will let you know. And the first time I dealt with it in the media space as a spokesperson, interestingly enough, is that the minister said to me, look, can you do some research on, you know, on everything and all of that, and then just give me some notes. And we had been asked by SABC to come and do an interview. There's a thing that a segment that they do, I think they still do it, there's something about In Numbers. They wanted to do an interview with us on how much the NHI is going to cost, 250 million rand, and a billion, sorry. So they wanted to, you know, probe that number and all of that. But what we had a deal with the minister at the time that I would always send him a list of ambush questions. And that was on the list of ambush questions.
Oh, so that's your preparation. Okay,
so that was
good.
Part of the preparation.
Did you have to any ambush questions?
They didn't ask. Yes, I did. I had a whole list. There was a list of about 5 or 6 potential ambushes, but they didn't ask about it. So, which was interesting. Okay. So then, then we did learn that, okay, now this thing is spreading very quickly. And the first kind of experience we personally had was that it had spread to Turkey. And there were 5 people in Turkey that had been identified. And we were supposed to fly to Turkey to learn about NHI in Turkey because their system is very good. So it was the minister and myself. Anyway, we're all packing and all of that. And the minister was in a cabinet meeting, and the idea was that he would, after cabinet, we'd all get on the flight and go. And so I was busy packing during cabinet, and apparently, I'm told, I think the minister told me that he went to the president after cabinet meeting and said, okay, well, just a reminder, I'm leaving, because you know you have to ask permission from the president. Just a reminder, I'm leaving now. And all that. And the president said, where are you going? And he said, we're going to Turkey to learn about NHI. And he said, aren't there 5 people infected there? And he said, yes. And he said, you're not going there.
Okay.
So we got a
good
phone
cupcake.
Call. Yeah. So we got a phone call and we stopped packing. Anyway. To fast forward, the first press conference we did on that was dedicated to COVID was when I was on the, I think it was on the 29th of, I think it was the 20, if I remember correctly, I think it was the 29th of December, when the Director General of World Health Organization declared it a public health emergency of international concern. That was the first press statement that we did. After that was then a closed-door meeting to determine what we're going to do when the virus hit the shores.
How did you feel at that moment?
It was surreal because that was when we then spoke about the 21-day lockdown. And
you already started talking 29th because I think it was in March.
No. I'm now fast-forwarding.
Oh, you're fast-forwarding. Jeez, I'm like, wow, okay.
No, I'm fast-forwarding now because we had the first case in March, but we did talk about the 21-day lockdown in February, March, in February because we could see that it was only a matter of time now. Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize that there was a lot of preparation that went in, a huge amount of surveillance. We're monitoring the situation very, very closely, and we're actually just waiting for this virus to actually come to our shores. And I think we did indicate that, actually, but I think people, it didn't really register. And we also, obviously, then at that point, did realize that we're dealing with a global pandemic and that it would actually be very, very serious. So we did start talking about the 21-day lockdown before, and then it happened. Now, almost from the get-go, when the first virus came, the conspiracy theories were already floating about. And in comms, that was probably the most irritating task, was getting all of these screenshots and WhatsApps from the minister where he was like, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this? So it was something that I was, and I was also not just my own minister, other ministers, other colleagues in communications, GCIS, constantly sending me screenshots and and links and all of that to all of this theories and misconception and all of that. And that is when we decided on the daily statement. We decided on the daily statement. We had an extremely tight communications program. We obviously set up ourselves and all of that, and our whole thing was that we're always going to be proactive, and that people must actually know that the information they're getting from government is the correct information. It was still not enough. Eventually, after a couple of months, we actually called together all the MNOs and all of the platforms, and I was leading that meeting, and I said to them, you have to treat your spaces like television. You must televise. We must organize the spaces and ensure that all of the misinformation and disinformation and all of that is somehow managed. You guys need to go back and deal with it. And they did. And you might have noticed that at some point, you know, you would go onto Facebook and there would be a pop-up.
Oh, yes, there was a notification.
From the World Health Organization, and it would be to go to the World Health Organization, click. That was after we had that conversation. And I give them credit for that, you know, all of them, Facebook, Twitter, and all of, they all did a fantastic job, and they worked very, very fast, and it helped. And then we got a report that South Africa was the second least infodemic country during COVID-19.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yes, yeah. So second least infodemic country during COVID. Yeah, and that was because of the amazing work that was done across the board. And we were also shocked to also learn, contrary to a lot of people's belief, from the HSRC, which is the Human Sciences Research Council, they did a study and they asked, who do you trust the most? And we were shocked to learn that they said government.
It makes sense.
Because we thought they were going to say, oh, social media or this or that, but they actually said government. So that made us very proud. And that is the point that I'm making about the issue of social media. It's a tool. It's a platform. There's no need to be intimidated by it.
Yes.
The only thing you must do is you must be mindful, and you must know what you want to get out of it. And then you collaborate. You collaborate with all the stakeholders that you need to collaborate with, including the MNOs and all of the platform owners, to actually get what you need out of it. And it is possible. I mean, you'll never eliminate misinformation, disinformation, but you can make people very conscious, just like people are actually becoming conscious of how heterogeneic the space is, and make them conscious enough to say, okay, I'm going to actually critically appraise the information that I'm getting so that I make sure that I'm able to filter out what is misinformation, disinformation, and what is information I can actually trust.
Yeah. Something that's really exciting me on the futurist horizon is, you know, when China has put the laws in place that you have to have an education and credentials to speak about health or to speak about any serious topics. I think that was a brilliant move because of all the misinformation that goes around many health topics, from losing weight to cancer. You know, there's a lot of controversial things that are happening. But I also think that we are going to see a lot of credfluencers of when they see this misinformation spreading is to tackle it right there and then, because they've got the expertise. And I hope that the platforms will start incentivizing people that's helping eliminate the misinformation.
Yes.
What I want to ask you is, we were all gobsmacked by how the world treated Africa during the pandemic. From the
shouldn't have come as a surprise.
I know. But I mean, I think that was the first moment where all of us were like, it was evident. Mm. There's no conspiracy theory about it or denial about it. The hoarding of, the vaccine from we're not being allowed to produce it locally. Mm. Talk me through what was going on behind the scenes and when you learnt about it, the challenges, etc.
Yeah, that was absolutely the bulk of my work with the African Union, is fighting for what we call biotech sovereignty and what the president and many others termed vaccine apartheid. But we took it further and we started to talk about all medical countermeasures, and we've actually instituted a process called the Johannesburg process, where we were dealing with issues of inequity. So what was it like dealing with this matter during the pandemic? Incredibly frustrating. Mm. Very, very frustrating. And I'll give one example, which was the example of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Yes.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine trial, a significant portion of the trial was done in this country. And by the way, I'm giving you this example because this example I can replicate it across a number of medical countermeasures, including HIV medication, where there have been persistent inequities despite the fact that as countries we've actually made investments. The trial was done here. One of the very important lead investigators of the trial, Professor Glenda Gray, is South African and is based here, processed the information and sent it to Johnson & Johnson. We had a company, Aspen, that wanted to make the, and did. They did, actually. But it was sent, but the product was under license, so the product was made in South Africa and sent somewhere else.
You're joking.
Yes. I'll give you an example of how painful incredibly painful it was with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So first, you may recall that there was the vaccine AstraZeneca that landed in the country, right? And we had hoped to use that because it was the first batch, and we only got 2 million. And this was kind of 2 million that they kind of said, okay, you can have that. But anyway, we thought we would use that to start, and we announced a start date. And then that day when it landed, from WITS, who was investigating, then called the minister and said, Minister, the vaccine's only 10% effective. Cannot use it. So then we said...
Were you testing it on animals?
No.
Excuse me.
It went through all the trial phases. It went through all the trial phases, but here's another piece of misinformation that people have, is that these drugs are ineffective because they were tested too fast. No. They were tested fast, but the advantage was that there was this very, very fast spreading disease and this very fast spreading bug. So normally a trial takes long just because the disease process is long. But in this case, you had a bug, it spread fast, sure. It caused disease very quickly, and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So you could actually do the trials very quickly.
That makes a lot of sense. I've never thought about it that way, because that's always bothered me, is how did we have a solution so quickly?
Didn't use new tech. It was tech that was repurposed. So, for example, for mRNA, the tech was developed actually for cancer and other diseases. But then because of what it is technologically, they looked at it and then they said, oh, we can actually repurpose it and actually do a vaccine. Mm. And also the other vaccines as well that are not new tech, not mRNA tech. I mean, this is all old tech. So it was just really just tweaked for coronavirus. And also coronavirus is a new virus. It's just that this one is a new strain. The COVID-19 that we know. So we already had other vaccines for other coronavirus, but this vaccine was then developed based on the information we had on our other crew and every day, and then the new information that was coming from. So there's a number of factors that made it possible for us to actually move very quickly with the trials on this vaccine. Anyway, so we turned to Johnson & Johnson. Despite the fact that we were part of the trials, Johnson & Johnson said to us that, no, they don't have anything for us, but what maybe we can do is we can collect all of the vials that have been left over from all the trials all around the world. So that's what we had to do. That's precisely what we had to do. And the healthcare workers that were vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson were vaccinated with those leftover vials from all over the world. And they had to be collected.
That is actually gross.
No, it's fine. There's no problem with that. There's no problem scientifically with that. The product was fine. There was no issue.
Okay.
But, of course, the inequity is what makes you angry.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, we as a country, we invested in these trials, just like all the other countries. But because we didn't put in the advance purchase, and other countries had put in the advance purchase, countries like Canada had put in advance purchases 9 times their population, you know, that hoarding that you were talking about. We could not access those drugs, and the only option was to get it. And it took us time, and the media was not kind to us because we had set a date when we would start. And I don't know if you remember, we were delayed. We'd set a date.
And there was stages that it was released.
Yes, but then it had to, of course, be in stages. Yeah, but that was for anybody, everybody in the world, and it was appropriate. But we'd set a date when we would start with the health workers, and we kept getting delayed. And we were delayed because the minister would be on the phone with the CEO of Johnson & Johnson night after night, trying to figure out a way for us to get these vaccines. And also, the other thing that they wanted was that they also wanted the no-fault compensation to be in place before they would give us.
What does that mean? Explain that.
Yeah. So what they wanted for us is that the country must set up a basically kind of like an insurance fund, that if anything should go wrong with the vaccination, the country must actually pay, not Johnson & Johnson. And that was a conditions precedent for us actually being able to even order for anything. Anyway, look, we fought. There was civil society fought that one. There was a court case where there was a determination made on that. But this was only recently.
My mind is. I look quiet on the outside, but on the inside, no, like an ant in my head.
I mean, I can talk about these things. It's all in the public domain. People can read about it in the news. But a lot of people obviously didn't know at the time that these were the struggles that we were going through as a ministry, trying to get these vaccines. So it took time. They said to us that. It'll take a month for all of these vials to be collected. We said in a month's time, everyone will be dead. So, or at least 20% of people who are infected will be dead, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And so we said, no, we don't have a month. We need to do this within at least a week. So that is what was done. They were collected, and about 200, or was it 400,000? I can't remember, but it was a couple of 100,000. They were delivered on a jet. And then we were able to vaccinate healthcare workers. Okay, now next, for our next phase, every single phase. So I'll just give you that one example because of time. But that example alone gives you a sense of what it's like in Africa to access medical countermeasures. And this is across the board. It's not just emergency medical countermeasures.
Yeah.
Anything that you see in the pharmacy, you must know that this government... Not the private sector, not doctors, not nurses, not opposition parties. The government fought tooth and nail to get that Panado, that antihypertensive, that antiretroviral into Dis-Chem, into Clicks, into your nearest pharmacy. Tooth and nail. And not just the country.
Sure.
The AU, the region, the WHO, some UN organizations like UNFPA, UNICEF, etc. These are all people I work with, and this is the bulk of my job, is fighting for equitable access to medical countermeasures.
I know this is a crazy question, but what can we do as Africans to be more independent from the rest of the world since they treat us so unfairly?
Firstly, you can join the fight, because if you go to a clinic or a hospital, whatever, and there's stockouts, it's probably not the government's fault. The fault is probably with the manufacturer, because they don't want to sell to our government. because they are selling to the EU or whoever, you know, and they've got advanced purchase agreements for the next 10 years, etc.
Because they have more money to put down.
Because they have more money to put down, they put down money already at the R&D stage, and they have.
You're such a diplomat. My blood is boiling.
they put the money down already at the R&D stage, and they contribute to R&D. That's always their justification.
Yeah.
Is that we paid for this research and development of this drug, so we get to be first in line for the drug, and that's the bottom line.
But how can we do these things on our own?
Yeah. So, firstly, for again, use social media. If you have a stockout,
if they will allow us and they'll shadow ban us,
right? If you have a stockout of a particular drug, right? Yes, fine. You can call and complain and all of that, but don't stop there. You look it up. Say, okay, I'm the one that has diabetes. I'm the one that needs this insulin, right? I've complained now to the government and to whoever, and they've told me that, you know, we're waiting for the orders to come in. Then look it up. Go online, Google what this thing is, who the manufacturers are, who the manufacturers sell to. Many manufacturers only sell to governments, or many manufacturers only sell very, very high demand drugs only to governments. Again, that's not a problem. But at least have an equitable regime. You know, it's not first come or first pay, first serve type of thing. It's first in need, first serve, you know, type of thing. But of course, it's a business. So anyway, look it up and then check to see who is participating in the fight to ensure that that particular medication actually comes into the country and that it is accessible. And you can, and then, and 99% of the time, you'll find out who it is. And they will actually say to you, they will have on their website, if you want to participate or if you want to write to us or if you want more information, here is the information. Anybody can participate in that fight because it's a very simple message. I'm a diabetic, or I have HIV/AIDS, or I have hypertension, and my life is at stake. Mm-hmm. And right now, these things are stocked out because you do not want to sell to our government.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, so the message is clear.
I wasn't even aware that this is an issue. It shows you, like, you know, my husband and I, we were driving over the holiday, and I think because of the G20 and of the rain and the holiday, you know, our grass wasn't cut in our neighborhood. And mm-hmm. we were like, you know, it's strange how we always think things must just be working automatically. Mm-hmm. And the moment it doesn't, you realize it. Mm-hmm. And then you don't realize actually the amount of work that goes on mm-hmm. behind the scenes. I mean, it's a very first world problem to worry about grass.
It's good to deliver something to the extent that people take it for granted that it's there.
Yes.
That is your ultimate aim as a government. Mm. It's actually your ultimate aim as a government. I think I said to you the one time, I know if I'm doing well if nobody says thank you or nobody or nobody says well done. That's when I know, okay, everybody's happy. They take it for granted that everything's working
the way it should.
Right. So anyway, the second thing that we need to do as certainly as a continent, and we are working on this, is that we do need to innovate and we do need to make our own tech.
Yes,
that is a long-term goal. We must have these fights, and then we must also fight for tech transfer. But what I found with the fight for tech transfer is that it is a difficult fight, and the tech that eventually gets transferred is usually the tech that's cliffing off that nobody else wants. Fine, if it's tech that works, that's fine.
Yeah,
you know?
I was just about to say, if it's work and it does
if
the
it
job.
Works, that's all very well. But you still, obviously, with the tech transfer, you can still encounter and you can still have the result of inequity. So the only way to really secure biotech access is for us to make it ourselves. So it's really, really critical that we invest in innovation. And investing in innovation, it sounds lovely. It's a very, very difficult thing to persuade investors to do because it's a lot of risk. It's the same level of risk as investing in movies and television, because 90% of the tech won't work.
You know, I know we're talking about health, but I mean, I'm just looking from a blanket approach. There was an incident where a guy from Nigeria, he invented a payment method, just spending $200 so that people can make payments in the rural areas. Mm. He went to investors to try and get people to, you know, help him to expand on the business. And he lost it because the tech companies are more interested in a technology that can remind you to switch your oven off.
Exactly.
You know, like first world problems. Mm. And they said that this is not scalable because it costs so little.
Yeah.
And this is the problem with innovation. This innovation has become this glitz and glamorous thing and not solving real world problems. Exactly. We shouldn't be having these conversations right now.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's why, again, it's so important. Local and regional tech development, R&D, is critical because, yes, others from other regions may not have an appreciation of our own idiosyncratic issues that we are trying to address. You know, they will always look at it from their own perspective. So, no, they're not going to invest. So African governments and African enterprises and African countries have to do the investment. And we have to, that's why we talk about this. Now, this is what health sovereignty means. People ask me a lot, we hear you talking about health sovereignty. What exactly does that mean? It sounds like a fancy term. What it means is that you secure, it means health security, right, in this case that we're discussing, through access to medical countermeasures, through tech that is developed and owned by Africans to address African problems.
Yes.
That is what tech sovereignty, biotech sovereignty means.
Yeah.
And that is what is critical, and this is what we need to focus on.
And it's also important, I mean, I had a doctor here last year to come and talk to us about one of their inventions, about a microbiome, the work that they've been doing for the skin. And in their research, they have found that the microbiomes of Africans are so different to the biomes
absolutely
in the rest of the world. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but it was fascinating to me. And I mean, like, if we health sovereignty also means that our people will be served better because we are so different and diverse.
Precisely, exactly. And you bring up a very good point, because even the issue of sovereignty even starts right from when you are doing trials, you know, right from when you're doing trials, because the way an African will design a trial will be very different to the way a European will design a trial in Africa, right? And this is often why we get incorrect results, because the trials are designed somewhere else in another region by other people. We have a very, very different perspective on life. And then they get executed here, and then they get a result, and they think, yes, this is the result. But actually, if you really, really critically appraise that trial and how it was done, elementally, you'll find that there were a lot of mistakes that were actually made. And had you addressed those mistakes, you would have gotten a completely different result.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that result, that they then use it to design the drugs. And then the drugs then come back here. Most of the drugs work. Some of them.
You sound like a song. Whose song is that? The drugs don't work.
most of the countermeasures will work, but some of them will not work.
Mm.
Precisely because the trial outcome was actually fundamentally incorrect because of the design flaws. So it's absolutely, it's something that, this is what we do in our work now, is to advocate for regional manufacturing. And that includes regional R&D. Regionally led.
Mm. So I'm going to ask you a question. So the whole world is saying that our jobs are going to be taken by AI. Mm.
Yes, they will be.
Will they be?
Absolutely.
So, okay. How are you going to take care of us, I'm asking? You know, we know that universal basic income, from what we look at here in South Africa and in Africa, hasn't worked so well.
We must remember what Ford said. Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Henry Ford.
Yeah.
When the car came, everyone was like, here go our livelihoods and all of that, because, you know, all the industries that were responsible for dealing with horses and making horseshoes and making cartwheels and making carts was going to go. And Henry Ford always said that, what he said is that with every technology comes new jobs and new opportunities.
That's very, very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's yes, these jobs that these we
understand. Jobs. I was just about to say these jobs for sure. I mean, if we look at the printing press, for example, the scribers that were doing the handwritten books,
they lost their jobs.
They lost their jobs, right? And they were livid about it, and they were reprimanding. And then all of a sudden, people had to build literacy. They had to learn how to read, and people expanded. They got a lot of information and knowledge, and because of that expansion of knowledge, they could contribute more meaningfully. Mm-hmm. And that is where typewriters were born.
Precisely.
And
now, the whole printing press industry is a multi-billion industry.
Look at it now. Mm-hmm. And now we digitized it. But anyway, and the same thing. I mean, I think the industry of the car is so interesting, because you had to get you know, it was chaos on the roads when people were driving, and there had to be legislation, urban restructuring, there had to be insurance, safety on the road. There was all of these jobs that were born from it.
That never were there before.
In terms of health for the youth listening to this, what should they be studying? Science for sure. I think science is still very, very important, and to drive that home. What advice can you give the younger generation on what to study for their futures?
You mean in terms of health?
Yeah, in your arena.
In our arena, okay. So first of all, you don't have to be studying medicine. Let me first say that, because there's too much pressure on young people. Oh, you must be a doctor, you must be a nurse, you must be this, you must be that. No, you don't need to study medicine at all. The health industry is massive, huge. And honestly, you can pretty much study whatever you like and find your way in the health industry if you really want to be in the health industry, or find your way in the health space. Or if it's just about your own personal health, again, I wouldn't say you need to study anything really. The health sector encompasses not just the biochemical part of things or the biology part of things. It has layers. So you have, of course, the person. You can think of it as concentric circles. So in health, you have the person, right, an individual. Then you have the family around them, which very, very much influences their health outcomes. You have the community around them, which influences health outcomes. You have the environment around that particular community and in the world. So that's all environmental sciences and all of that. You have policy and economics and all of that, which all directly influence at population level health outcomes. And actually, I'm glad you asked me this question, because it's often a fight that we have with other sectors, where when we want to draw them into the health conversation, they'll be like, oh, no, I don't understand this, you know, this is not important for me, or whatever. Pretty much health is the one space that touches everybody's lives. Absolutely, yes. Everybody's lives. Yes. Okay, telecommunications doesn't necessarily touch everybody's lives. It should, but it doesn't necessarily. And it's not a disaster if it doesn't touch somebody's life. I mean, it's not great for their, you know, prospects, or whatever. But still, it's not a disaster. They're not going to die just because they don't have a telephone. They're not going to die if they don't have electricity. They're not going to die, you know, if they don't have a television. If they don't have, but they will die if they don't have a clinic, or a hospital nearby, or healthcare, and all of that. Now, to have a clinic, you have to build it. There's brick and mortar. You don't need medicine for that. You have to build roads. You have to staff it. You have to have tech. You have to have blood pressure machines and all sorts of machines and all of that, and monitors and blah, blah, blah. You have to have beds, right? And mattresses. You have to have sheets. And, you know, so you can see how absolutely any industry.
I love how you've painted that picture.
Well, it's because it's the reality. Yes. It really is the reality, you know. And for those of us who are in policy, we're very acutely aware of the realities of what it means to actually deliver quality health care to people. Delivering quality health care to people is a multi-sectoral activity. And so really, you know, I would just say you must study. If you would like to be in the health space, first consider what it is that you like doing, okay? If you like, if you're engineer orientated, you can make ventilators.
Yeah,
you know, engineers who, one particular engineer who's a very good friend of mine, he's actually an engineer that mainly does most of his work in infrastructure and in defense, but when COVID came, he made ventilators. Okay, now another infuriating story. He made ventilators. We couldn't buy them. I don't know why we couldn't buy them. So he ended up selling them to Germany. But anyway, the point I'm making is that, you know, he's an engineer, but he made a very, very important contribution to health outcomes of Germans. There were some Germans that would have benefited from his ventilators.
Wasn't the sanitizer born here?
The actual
sanitizer many, many years ago was actually born here.
I do think that is the case. Yeah. All right. Well, it was a South African doctor that did the study that said that you have to wash your hands. It did take a study for us for that penny to drop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is possible that then the sanitizer.
I remember many, many years we do pandemic prevention over here. I'm just saying. Okay. So Before we move on to the next section, I want to ask you a quick question in terms of medical aids. You know, there is this thing going around on social media about this new medical aids popping up, and it costs only $100 or $200. Mm. How do we know what's real and what's not? Because there's a lot of misinformation around medical aids and subscribing to these things and to protect citizens. Can you elaborate?
Yeah. Sure. So it's simple to actually find out. You can just contact the Board of Healthcare Funders, because that is the body that legitimizes and oversees all of the medical aids. And or you can contact the Council for Medical Schemes as well. You can just go on the website and they will have all of the medical aids listed. And I would certainly discourage people from onboarding on medical aids that are just being established standalone. So what I'm like, for example, let's say a very well-established bank like Standard Bank decides to go into that's fine, because I mean they're a well-established bank, they have very, very good financial policies and all of that. Yeah, but the ones that are just standing up on all on their own, that I would be very careful of.
Yes.
I mean, there's enough medical aids that, you know, are long-standing and, you know, have a track record and, you know, and are able to deliver. And even they are struggling because they're having to raise their prices all the time and reduce the benefits and all of that, you know, to try and make it all work. So, yeah, be very careful of fly-by-nights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful advice. Okay, Nawazi, let's go into the little girl you were. All right. Did you always know that you wanted to be a doctor? Did you not think that this is your calling to serve?
No. All I knew was that, and what was always imprinted on me, is that I must serve. And part of my realization of the lack of reality of my not wanting to be in service is that, you know, I was told very categorically that I had a duty to serve. And the implication was that I would be serving in politics. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. As late as I think kind of beginning of the year matric, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. But then I kind of just said, okay, I like people, I like science, what is a good combination? Okay, a doctor. And that was the only reason why I ended up applying. And I can tell you now that within weeks of first year, I immediately regretted it. I was very disappointed. I thought that university was going to be a space where we explore and experiment and really like probe our brains and push ourselves. And it ended up being more about kind of just drilling protocol into us, really, you know. Fine, that's safe. But for somebody that has a highly inquiring mind and that really wants to push themselves, it's not really a stimulating environment. But anyway, I decided that I would stick with it and finish, and I did. But in retrospect, I probably, if I knew what I knew now, I may not have studied medicine. Yeah.
And I mean, how did this world collide? Like you said earlier on that you were in filming and business, plus you're a doctor, a medical doctor. How does this, I mean, you obviously sound like an acutely curious person.
Yes, that's precisely what I'm indicating, is that from almost the moment, you know, I experienced medical school, I knew I wasn't going to be in it forever, or at least not practicing as a doctor. So I was always on, you know, I always had a roving, let's say, mentality and eye and ear and everything, looking for other things that could be of interest to me. And when the film and television industry came to me, and it really, I think all the spaces I've been in, they came to me, but it goes back to my show up, you know, assertion, you know, that, you know, with opportunities, opportunities come to you every single day, all the time. Mm. Every person gets opportunities. I do not buy any narrative that says I don't have opportunities. I think it's anybody who says that to me, I think it's absolute bullshit. Opportunities are always coming to you, but you've got to have your eyes open, you've got to have your ears open, and you've got to be ready to pounce.
And put in the work, yeah.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, film and television industry, even DJing, certainly being a spokesperson, politics, and now working in global health diplomacy. They all came to me, but there was always something that, or at least a philosophy, that I did come out of in being a doctor, and that is that I was deeply concerned working in the emergency unit.
Yeah.
That everything that we are seeing is as a result of societal or systemic injustices, mm-hmm. Or failures or inadequacies, not actually as a result of an actual medical cause. Right? The medical cause was just the result, the manifestation of everything that was going wrong in the society that this particular person lives in. So my whole thing was always that, okay, I've seen the results now. I've treated people. There was a lot of revolving door syndrome precisely because we were sending them back to the very thing that got them sick. So my whole thing was I want to actually come out of here and I want to claw my way backwards until I get to the source of what is going wrong and that what is getting people into hospital. Because I was certainly convinced that it was not them, nor necessarily the way that, you know, they live their daily lives. Because listen, I'll give you a very, very good an everyday example, right? Our cleaners, most of them walk a lot, okay? Most of them eat, say, maltabela in the morning. Mm. Or oats, or porridge, which is not great, but anyway. But they will eat something that is actually healthy, right? When they come home, they'll usually have, if they can't afford meat, they will at least have a potato, beans, spinach, right? This is what we call a vegan diet.
And, calling it out! Yeah, I love right? that.
Okay, so they walk a hell of a lot more than any of us do. And they eat, most of them, most of the time is a vegan diet, okay, but many of them are fat, right, and many of them have hypertension and diabetes, right, a lot of them are going to get stabbed or shot or something. What's causing that? It's not their lifestyle. They're cleaning and walking most of the time. They generally eat a healthy diet most of the time. Why have they got hypertension, diabetes, obesity, getting shot, getting stabbed, getting beaten up? It's got nothing to do with their own lifestyle.
What did you learn?
No, I learned that it's a societal problem. This is the point I'm making, is that we have to fix all of the issues around this person for them to be healthy. I can't. And you know what we used to do when we were doctors? Reduce your sugar. Exercise more. You know, don't eat more salt. Eat this kind of diet. You know, and now I see their faces. They would look at me. Like
show you how important community is as well.
Huh? They would look at me like I was talking absolute nonsense, and I was. You know, I absolutely was, because they were doing all of those things, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is not what was causing them to be diabetic, hypertensive, fat, you know, being subjected to trauma, physical trauma, and all of those things.
Do you think as a society, because the more developed a country becomes, the more we're losing community, do you think that has something to do with it?
Hugely. Hugely, because mental health, which unfortunately is something that we simply do not pay enough attention to.
It's a huge problem.
It is a massive problem. Isolation is actually a killer. It's, in my opinion, social isolation and mental stress is just as bad as diabetes, hypertension, if not maybe even worse, as diabetes, hypertension. It is the cause of all of these lifestyle diseases of lifestyle. I think it's probably a very poor term, because as I say, you know, some people's lifestyles are exactly the right lifestyles, but they still have those problems, so something else is wrong. So in policy, it's a massive gap, and unfortunately, exactly as you say, the way society is going, the way we are now structuring things mainly around commercialism, is unfortunately leading to issues of societal isolation, social disintegration, and as a result, mental and physical health.
Sure. There's so much work to do, you know, and I think this leans into the conversation that we need to have around diplomacy and politics. I can put my hand up. I don't like politics at all.
Don't worry, no politician likes politics either.
I don't like it. It makes me very uncomfortable. I like for everybody to get along, kumbaya, then I'm all happy. And I feel like you can be more productive like that, but you have to deal with a lot of personalities and those around you, and diversity and inclusion is important. And, you know, if we look at innovation, you're going to need that. But at the end of the day, if we want to call, so this community is about now about 10,000 conscious leaders, MPOs, NGOs, change agents, etc. We want to be the change in the world. We want to, you know, stand for societal injustices, and we want to, you know, create movements and awareness around a lot of societal issues. We have to learn how to be political, because if we want to change policy, if we want to have a voice, and women, you and I had a conversation around that, women are more leaning in towards solving problems, being change agents, wanting to make a difference. And one of the core things, just as you mentioned around health, it's what you build, the skills that you need to build around the change that you want to create. I want us to perhaps talk around the conversation. What does diplomacy mean to you, and political literacy?
Okay, so I have, I don't know if this is going to be good news or bad news.
Oh, you comment.
But I'm afraid you're already a politician. The moment you call yourself a change agent, the moment you call yourself a conscious leader, you're a politician.
I suppose.
You
maybe
are
it's the
a
perception.
Politician. You need to just settle that in your mind that you're a politician. Now, the reason why people are deterred by politics is because I would say it's because of the media. I'm not saying it's the media's fault. I'm just saying that that is where they consume, and they understand the arena of politics. But that is not, I mean, it's only a small part of politics. So politics is not about parliamentary brawls and party and political parties and mudslinging. I mean, all of that, we call it grandstanding. We actually have a term for that. It's grandstanding.
But the public thinks it's real.
The public, no, it is real. No, it's absolutely real. No, they are right. But the public thinks, oh, that is politics, you know, and that is where it begins and it ends, you know. No, we and those of us in politics, we actually have a term for that kind of behavior, right? Grandstanding. And the reason why we call it grandstanding is precisely that. You're getting up there, you're saying what you need to say. You may or may not be right? In fact, let's assume that you are absolutely correct in what you're saying. But you're not saying it because you want to improve people's lives, or you want to change things or whatever, you know, or you want to, deal with the lawmaking. You're doing it to build your own political capital so that you can stay in power, and so that you can continue, or the party or your party can continue. That is what they're doing it for. They're not doing it for politics. They're doing it for personal or party gain. Right, so that is why we call it grandstanding, because it's a smoke and mirrors tactic that people use in politics. And indeed, politics is full of that kind of thing because, and this is my own personal opinion, I think it's just the kinds of people that politics tends to attract, right? I won't go into it, but I just think that politics does tend to attract a certain kind of people, but that needs to be corrected by indeed correcting the narrative of what politics is, right? I read somewhere, and I think ironically, I might have read this in Mein Kampf. I did read Mein Kampf.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I think ironically I might have read this in Mein Kampf, but anyway, what I read was that politics is about people, and that has always stuck with me because I read it at a very, very young age, and there was a full stop at the end of that sentence. Politics is about people, full stop. You know, so this is what I've always understood, and certainly this is what my parents and my grandmother instilled in me as well. In fact, they instilled in me that politics is about service, you know, and about building the country and nation building and all of that. So many people, including your listeners here, will tackle a problem partly by saying to people like us, we need political will. Okay. And I've stopped there because that's what they say to us, right? We need political will. And I always counter that with, what do you mean by that?
Mm.
Okay. If what you mean, what they most of the time what they mean is that we need heads of state and ministers to agree to XYZ ABC. Fine. That's all very well. Then we deliver that. And we say to them, right, there's your political will, at least the way that you have defined it. It's done now. We've delivered it. And then things don't move. You see, that is now where is your political will?
Yeah.
Right. Political will is not about heads of state, ministers, council, ward councillors, and all of that. Political will is about you. Hmm. What is my... So that's the first thing you must ask. What is my political will? And how can I attain that before you go and ask a minister and a head of state? And I'll tell you why that is important. It's because that's just the sustainable thing to do.
Yeah.
Heads of state, ministers, councillors, and all of that, the best they can do for you, the absolute best they can do for you, is to deliver a law or a platform. That's it.
Mm.
They cannot build your roads. They won't build your roads. Somebody else will build the roads. And that's where clever people then come in and they say, oh, there's this law that says that I can build a road between here and here. And all I have to do is get these two districts or municipalities to agree to it, you know, and then they can pay me. You know? And then people complain and say, oh, these horrible developers come in and, you know, and gentrify. No, they exercise their political will. They studied what was there, what the politicians have set up. They looked at it and they said, right, as a company, this is our policy. We want to build roads, or we want to build houses, or we want to sell sweets, or we want to sell toothpaste or whatever. And so we are going to talk to this minister. We're going to talk to this councillor. We're going to talk to that landowner. And we're going to talk to these people. And we're going to make sure that we get them to agree to our company policy. Once they've all agreed... We have a company policy. This is our political will, is basically what they're saying. Get them to agree. And and we can build our road. We can sell our toothpaste. We can sell our sweets.
Where this becomes very tricky for me, and I think you have a very good point, it's like you really study what is written, what you can and can't do. Like, I'm just thinking there's a lot that I actually don't know. Like, I really need to get going. I mean, what's the starting point? Like, as a change agent, like, where do I need to go and start doing my research to make sure I know what I can and can't do? Maybe creating opportunities, because I'm just thinking in my head, why are all these international companies developing our country? Why can't we do it?
It's political will. It's their political will as a country. They have made a decision. I say as a company, not as a country. I am Coca-Cola. Where did Coca-Cola start? I want to say America, but I feel like that might be the wrong answer. I can't remember. But anyway, I have started in this America? Country as Coca-Cola. My objective, our objective now, is to move to other markets. That is already political will. We have an objective to move to other markets. Right. Now.
Are you listening, ladies?
Now. What do we need to do to be able to move to those other markets? Okay, I want to move into the South African market. Okay, CEO, can you please go and talk to the Minister of DTIC and find out what I need to do to be able to actually get into that market?
Hmm.
Okay, and then you take it from there. How can you, if you have something that you want to do and you need to exercise your political will, how do you do it? Once again, you have social media. You have the internet as an incredible tool. And the beauty about it is that the technology is getting better and better and more organized. You can literally say, I want to sell toothpaste in South Africa. I am in Germany. Tell me what to do. And it will probably give you a step-by-step of exactly what it is that you need to do, and it will probably be correct.
Yeah.
Right? And then you have to actually do it.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. I mean, you know what my goals are. And when you told me what it is that I have to do, I was like, oh my word, this is going to be a lot of hard work.
Yes.
And like, it's great on paper and it's a great conversation. Yeah. Sorry, I can't tell you all about it. But I mean, like, it's a great conversation. But then looking at the work that it requires, from the political will into action, that is the big job, right?
It absolutely is.
So Let's talk about diplomacy. I think it is such a beautiful skill that you have, and I want you to give us some tips on how to be more diplomatic. Mm. If I had to endure, because I don't know, like when I see injustices, I get very angry. Mm. If I had to endure and keep my mouth shut, I would be fired because I will not do that.
Yes.
Somehow you managed to keep it calm and collective. And also, if we look at Cupcake, we can call him Cupcake, nobody else can. But when we look at, for example, Cyril, when with that whole incident with the G20 and how he handled that and the diplomacy.
It was pure mastery. Absolute mastery.
And even the other incident that happened, you know, I'm not going to give it credit. I don't want to mention certain people's names. But that incident alone showed you this, it's an art. Mm. And you work closely with Cyril. So teach us a little bit about what do we need to do to be more diplomatic, because it seems to be the skill that really can help you to persuade with your political will and to drive the change.
The first thing you have to do is work on your emotional intelligence. So that is something, anyway, everybody has to do it. But if you want to be a diplomat, that's the number one thing, is to work on your emotional intelligence. Because diplomacy often necessitates that you have to engage in discourse, and at times collaborate very, very closely with people that you can't stand. Your conduct has to be above reproach at all times. So controlling your emotions, okay, and controlling your emotions doesn't mean suppressing them. In fact, if anything, it's extremely important to be very, very aware of the emotion that the other party is actually arousing in you, right? If you feel anger, you need to actually really, really acknowledge it and say, I am angry because this person doesn't want to give me vaccines. Okay, I am very, very angry about that. And that is absolutely fine, right? Now you deal with what you need to deal with. So emotional intelligence doesn't come by saying, I'm going to be emotionally intelligent. I'm going to be a better person. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up, and every day I'm going to wake up and I'm going to recite my affirmations to myself. No, it doesn't work like that.
It's hard work.
Absolutely doesn't work like that. It is. Everyday hard work, mindfulness is a very, very important aspect of it. But it is about very, very intensely studying how it is that you react to a particular situation, and then coaching yourself on a daily basis and practicing it with your family, with your friends and all of that, on how you're going to actually respond to that in an effective way that is going to get you the results that you want. Okay, so that is the absolute, probably the most important thing, right? The second thing is preparation. Preparation is absolutely key. And when I say preparation, I don't necessarily mean research and all of that. I mean that you need to prepare yourself for the actual interaction with the other party or other parties, okay? And what you are preparing is you are anticipating their content or conduct, right? And you are ready to counter it and take the discourse forward. So you're not just going to say, I don't like that. You're going to say, right, these are the aspects that I find challenging, right? I also understand where you are coming from with the things that you find challenging, right? Then you've got to very carefully, the most successful diplomats I have seen are the ones who will cogently take all parties through all of the permutations and point out what the pitfalls are in a very, very objective manner, so that there cannot be any pushback, because you have actually laid out a very, very cogent argument as to why your proposition is the proposition that should be considered. And then you must be prepared to compromise. You absolutely must be prepared to compromise. And that one is often a very, very bitter pill to swallow. And can actually lead to an outcome that you actually didn't want. But at the same time, it's better to have an outcome that you don't want than to have a war. because that's in diplomacy, that is a reality. In any diplomatic space, a reality is that you could actually start a war.
But doesn't it seem sometimes, I mean, I'm just, from my perspective, it looks like war is what people want.
No, actually, I know a lot of people think that.
Yeah.
Nobody wants a war.
Yeah.
No one wants a war. Honestly, no one wants a war. I think I have now encountered enough bloodthirsty people to know that as much as they're blood, they actually don't want a war.
Okay.
A war is one of the most, it's just, it's, I can't find the word now, but it really is something you really just don't want to have to deal with. People are, you're dealing with dead people and you're going to get blamed from the dead people. It is extremely expensive. It will always go on longer than what you anticipated. It's exceptionally draining on your economy and on your human resources. And you always find yourself having to build up after a war. So no one wants a war, but what they do want is what they want. Okay, if they want gold or if they want a particular piece of land and all of that, that is what they're after. And what they will say is that if it comes to war, so be it. But I can tell you right now, nobody wants a war. And that is actually often the premise upon which many of us enter into a negotiation, is that you start with, well, nobody wants this.
Mm.
This is the part we don't want. All right, so, okay, at least we're clear about that. And we're clear about what are the outcomes that can lead to a war or, you know, to you not getting something or whatever. You know?
Yeah.
Now, let's work on what we both want and let's see where we can arrive at a compromise. And again, you know, the issue of compromise, you have to really come to terms with compromise. And it's a difficult thing for humans.
Yeah.
Humans find compromise very difficult, especially 21st century humans, because we are taught that if you compromise, it means that you've lost something. You know, it means that, you know, you are the one that has been somehow undermined. You know, you're taught that then you failed as a person or as a professional. You know, whereas we shouldn't have really been taught that. Then the last thing is that you've got to actually first listen, and you must be, ideally you must be the last to talk. Ideally, I mean, it's not always possible, but if possible, you try to be the last to talk, because by listening, you're able to pick up on what all the parties are saying. You're able to pick up on the areas of convergence, and then you're able to reconcile some of the areas of divergence, and you're able to very clearly delineate where there will never be consensus. And the most successful diplomats I have seen are the ones who are able to reflect back to the group or to that other party what the conversation has actually been about, and everyone says, ah, yes, indeed, that is what we're talking about. Because people just talk and they talk and they talk, and they don't really monitor where the conversation is going, and all they're monitoring for is, are we going to get what we want?
Yeah.
You know, somebody has to be that mirror, and this is where they place very, very good facilitators or conveners or negotiators, you know, to be able to reflect back what the conversation is about, where it's going. And sometimes you will find that what you thought you wanted isn't actually what you wanted, only because somebody actually took the opportunity to listen and to dissect what you are saying, and then to reflect back to you to say, no, but what I heard from you is that actually you actually want this, not that, you know. And that will often then lead to a much more favorable outcome, because then you're actually able to then reconcile the differences and come to an agreement.
What I love what I'm hearing from you, it sounds to me that there's a lot of preparation that goes into diplomacy and negotiation.
Very, very important.
Talk me through that.
Yeah. So the preparation is very, very intense before you enter into any diplomatic space. And it's very, very important. Number one is to really identify all of the stakeholders that are part of that particular issue and get their inputs. Okay, before you even are going, get everybody's inputs and a clear understanding. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. They don't have to be. In fact, I prefer always to start with civil society.
Mm.
It's always, for me, a very, very important starting point. Because when you get to the experts, there tends to be some, let me call it expert bias, you know. Highly technical and highly expert people tend to be extremely academic, and will give you advice that is probably good and sober, but may not necessarily be the correct advice.
Mm.
Okay? This happened a lot in COVID. by the way. Yeah, we were given advice. It was very good advice, but we had to consider some realities.
Yeah.
For example, I'll just give you one example, the issue of taxis. We were told that you have to have a seat in between. It was absolutely not possible. You know, sure. There were too many other realities we had to consider. Anyway, so I personally prefer to start with civil society and get the inputs of just ordinary people, you know, through representatives or through just ordinary people, not experts. Why? Because at the end of the day, the decisions that we make affect those people, you know, and affect their daily living and their daily lives and their lived experience. So you don't want to be making a decision that seems academically sound, but in reality then, you know, it doesn't actually mean anything or actually may have a deleterious effect on those that will be impacted by that political decision. Yes, then very important to get the expertise in and to get guidance. And this is where a lot of the diplomacy fails. If you fail to bring in all of the sectors that are relevant to this discussion, you're going to find that you have a pitfall, right? And this is often, I think, where a lot of people
and
lose
a lot
it.
Of businesses go wrong.
Exactly.
Departments that don't talk to each other.
Precisely. Yep. Exactly. Right. Yeah. I actually found this in the film industry. When I started in the film industry, they said to me, DTIC and NFEF and SABC and all, you know, basically all the ones who are involved, they don't talk to each other. So I said, well, let's get them to talk to them. You'll never get them to talk to each other. Anyway, it's absolutely nonsense. We did get them to talk to each other. Very critical to get every single or as many as possible of all of the sectors that have a bearing on this particular discussion involved. The ones who have prepared accordingly in that regard are the ones who are going to win, because they are the ones who are going to go into the negotiation and say, but did you consider that your decision is going to have a deleterious impact on this sector? And this sector is very important for you because of X, Y, Z, A, B, C. So in fact, your outcome is going to actually, this result is going to actually undermine the outcome that you want. Did you think about that? You know.
That. I get you. So you almost like to have to look at all of their angles and blind spots.
Exactly.
Yes, right? And pull it out.
Then, and then the final part of the preparation is just you centering yourself before you go in to say, you know, clarity of thought, cogent arguments, emotional quotient, you know, just before you walk into that room. And this is super important because I have seen so many times people work each other up in the corridors. Oh, this country, they said this. Oh, yes, you know, those guys are absolute assholes. Yeah, when we go back in after lunch, we're going to show them. You know, and then they go in and go in guns blazing, and they've lost it.
You see why I don't like politics.
and they've lost it. They, you know, they lost it the moment they decided after lunch they're going to get so-and-so. You know,
see what you're
saying. So that's just mental preparation. Centering yourself is also extremely, extremely critical.
I mean, this is also a lesson for everyday citizens on social media. Absolutely. Like, you know, ground yourself.
Yeah.
It's so important. I mean, I want to go back to what you said about emotional intelligence. The book that I'm writing is around the new Renaissance and that we need authentic intelligence in the age of AI. And authentic intelligence consists out of 7 intelligences. One is creative, creativity. One is emotional intelligence, foresight intelligence, spiritual intelligence. You know, there's a whole list.
You need all of those for good diplomacy.
Okay.
And some.
My 7 intelligences. Yes. There you go. Mm-hmm. Because when you are able to lead audacious inside out, is how are you responding to truth and expressing it into the world?
Absolutely. I really, really like that because the truth is the truth at the end of the day. Whether you cover it up with all sorts of, you know, smoke and mirrors and grandstanding, all of that, the truth is the truth. Everybody who's sitting around their table knows what the truth is, you know, and how you surface that truth, you know, is through all of those 7 intelligences and all of that. And you are going to make people angry. You are going to ruffle feathers. And, you know, they may not have done the work that you have done to become a good diplomat, and they will make you feel it, you know. And, in fact, you may not even get the outcome that you were looking for despite all of your best efforts, right? But it's sad that, unfortunately, as humanity, this happens, but the truth always out. In fact, we are right now currently dealing with the truth that's outed. I won't be able to discuss it now. We're right now dealing with the truth that's outed, that we had expressed to colleagues 2 years ago to say that if you deal with this particular section of the negotiation like this, we can tell you right now, you'll never, ever, ever be able to actually deal with this thing again. And now it's happened. And they came to us and said, help us. We said, sorry. Do you remember that we sent this letter saying that this will happen? Yes. The point I'm making is that we all know the truth, and the truth will come out eventually. It will come out eventually, and people will say it was that person who tried to tell us, who tried to warn us, who tried to let us know that this is what is actually happening. Nobody will forget who actually surfaced the truth. Nobody. They may not say it in the outline, but they will know who is the one that surfaced the truth. That diplomatic capital, nobody. I mean, it's priceless. That is what makes the difference between respectable, respected, well-seasoned, and diplomats that get used again and again and again. You know, people like Kofi Annan were used again and again and again for the highest level diplomacy, right? Nelson Mandela was used again and again and again to try and broker peace and all of that kind of stuff. So Ramaphosa gets used again and again and again. You know, why? Because there are people who are going to say, do you remember when Ramaphosa said this? Do you remember when Kofi Annan said this? Do you remember when Mandela said this? You know, the truth. So super, super important to be comfortable with the truth and to be comfortable speaking it and be comfortable knowing that it may not be acknowledged and it may not even lead to the outcome that you want right there and then, but be ready when everybody else is ready.
Yeah.
And be ready to take action at that point, or to say, unfortunately, at this point, we can't deal with it anymore. But now that you're all aware of the truth and now you all acknowledge it and you realize that it's not going to help you to deny it, let's try something else.
You know, I always think about truth. If you look at somebody going through a midlife crisis, when they are exposed to the truth and the reality of everything going wrong in their lives, what happens is there is a moment of either you're changing or you're choosing. No matter what is happening, what you need to confront is either you're going to step forward or you're going to sit in the void for the rest of your life. And you can choose which way you're going to go. But usually beyond that, once you have faced the truth, is where your best work is born.
It's usually much, much better if you just confront the truth and then get on with it.
And get on with it. Yeah. Exactly.
if you're constantly evading the truth, which is what most of us do all the time, you're moving backwards.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. You're moving backwards. You may think you're moving forwards, but it will come for you. It's not that it's going to come for you. The truth is, it's just going to stay there.
And it's going to get louder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's just going to stay exactly where it is. And at some point, you'll...
Different storyline, different characters, but same vibe.
Same truth.
Yeah, same truth. I want to... And something that you said that's so powerful. I met Jay Naidu the other day. Such an incredible guy. And for those of you who don't know, he was one of the fathers of our democracy.
Absolutely.
And he said something so powerful. We don't need another Madiba. We need to bring out the Madiba within us.
Absolutely.
And what I'm learning so much from you today is being grounded, being centered, being a good leader, being aware, being curious, being able to confront things, being truthful. If I look at your entire kaleidoscope of experiences and what you've done in your life, where you are right now and where you are positioned, from my perspective, it almost looks like you are called for this. This is your calling. You have been born to do this. And we can learn so much from you. But what is next for you, ambition-wise? Is this your purpose, or do you have something else in mind? Are you going to run for president? I mean, I'm just asking. What is your take on ambition and purpose?
So, I'd firstly, before I talk about myself, I'd firstly just like to challenge the notion of having a cause or a passion or, you know, a calling, you know. And it's very simple from my perspective. Every time I've changed careers, people have said to me, is this your passion now? I want to challenge this notion of a calling, a passion, all of that. All I know is that I serve. That's all I understand about myself. I'm somebody who was told that there's an expectation that I must serve. It was ingrained, deeply ingrained in me. And I can say that every time I have respected that expectation, and every time I have served, I've done something in service, I've been successful. Anytime I did something because I said, I'm so passionate about this, let me see what, or I want to make money, never succeeded. I really have never succeeded on that premise. Also, I want to say that a lot of people want to make money, be prosperous and be rich and all of that. There's nothing wrong with that. But I do want people to just consider, who is rich out there in this world? Who are the rich people? The rich people are not doing anything glamorous at all. They're selling cups. They're selling toothpaste. They're selling toothbrushes. They're selling cars. They're selling tables. They're doing the most mundane landscaping. They're doing the most mundane everyday work that you, or selling or creating products that you and I need to use every single day. They're actually, and if you speak to a lot of them, especially the ones who are actually innovators, they will tell you that my purpose was to solve a humanitarian problem, right? I met the CEO of Colgate in New York the one time when I was traveling. I was actually, we were traveling to Unga, and they invited us to, it was kind of like an evening cocktail, in their penthouse. And, I had preconceptions. I was like, we're going into a penthouse, Trump, these people, I've never been so inspired by my life, because when I spoke to that CEO, he was saying to the minister, listen, minister, oral health is only number 98 on the list of UN, issues to tackle. It'll never be tackled in my lifetime. And yet people don't understand how important oral health. He literally went on and on about the importance of oral health and why it's important for, the entire. The only thing that man was interested in was oral health. That was the humanitarian crisis for him. That he was solving for. He wasn't trying to get rich from selling Colgate. That was a byproduct of what was done, of what he has done and the work that he has done. So a lot of people are often searching for prosperity through their passion or prosperity through their calling, etc. I think it's far, far, far more helpful if you identify a humanitarian issue and you see what it is, what your role is in dealing with that issue.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree.
And yes, very, very important to have a living and all of that. And let me just say, maybe as one of my final lessons, is that once you have now identified what you want to do, ladies, gentlemen, those who need to learn this lesson, know your worth.
Yeah.
When you've decided you're going to do a job, name your price. Name your price and say, this is how much it's going to cost for me to do this work. And if you're not going to pay me that, I'm walking away. Because when I do this work, you're going to get 100% out of me. Bring the passion, bring the cause,
beautiful.
Bring the calling with you into anything that you do.
Oh, this is such a beautiful advice. I love it so much. I think I need to hear this message from you today. Like, I'm taking that as my call to action for the year.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Mm.
Because there's always this thing of serving means no money, means
and ask any billionaire, they will tell you that service is prosperity.
Yeah, because everybody benefits, right?
Everybody benefits, yeah. And so do you.
Yeah, beautiful. So I want us to close off, but I want to do something different because you are our first politician to be in the House, and I want you to give. Oh, you didn't answer my question.
Oh, am I going to run for office? Watch this space.
You heard it first in here. Just saying. Okay. I want you to look into your camera.
This one.
And I want you to speak to our audience and to conscious leaders and give them a special message. You said in the beginning, show up. I want you to bring it all together for us and impart it to our audience.
You have everything that it takes to do what you need to do and to contribute to society. It's all there. You have it all. Go ahead and do it. Try not to think too hard about doing it, because that is what is going to deter you and make you feel overwhelmed. Take the first step, then the next step, then the next step, and trust that you have everything that you need, either within you or at your disposal, to be able to make it all the way across the finish line with whatever it is that you choose to do. And then when you do cross that finish line, make sure that you are ready for the next race. Because as Madiba said, when you climb a mountain and you get to the top, you only find that there's other mountains to climb. Be ready to climb all the mountains.